Hello, and welcome to the Idea Medic podcast with first aid for your idea muscle. In this episode, I'm talking to JD Hoovener, a US patent attorney and founder of boldip.com. He offers his advice on protecting both creative work and inventions. Hi, JD. Thank you for joining me on the podcast. I wonder if you'd mind telling me a little bit about you, your background, and what you do now.
Absolutely. Yeah, thanks again for having me, Tara. I have a passion for innovation. We have at the firm here at Bold IP, where we help work with inventors and business owners, and I'm able to put forward the background I've had in engineering. I started out in industrial and systems engineering work. I worked at Boeing, an aircraft manufacturing company here based out of Seattle and Everett, Washington, and enjoyed about 10 years of work there and was inspired to become a patent attorney at the onset of my the capstone rather of my business school curriculum at sort of a Shark Tank, if you're familiar. And it was really my inspiration for going into IP, intellectual property, and I decided to tackle the legal education and move forward. I knew going into law school that I wanted to become a patent attorney and open up my own practice.
So did you ever patent any of your own ideas?
Well, they're pending. I have three. I've got three. They're kind of funny. One of them is about a new way of practicing law, which is interesting. In Europe, and it's interesting that we're speaking over there, London is non-legal members can be owners of law firms. Basically, non-attorneys can be owners or part owners. Whereas in the U.S., it's not allowed under ethical rules. And so I have sort of devised a plan, a structure of business organizations so that through a holding company can actually sell shares of law firms. I think it will work, but I've got a provisional patent application on that. Actually, I have a non-provisional one. And a couple of things for as our children were growing up, and they're still growing up, baby seat invention, sort of a head helmet protection device, some little fun things I decided to file along the way.
Of course, so you've got both sides as sort of the inventor sort of person and also the other side, the IP.
Right.
Cool. So could you just give me a little bit of overview of the types of IP protection that creatives can get? Because I don't necessarily think everybody knows what is applicable to sort of what type of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so I like how you said creatives. That's perfect. You know, we do work with artists and authors, and that domain is copyright. When one person puts something from their mind onto something tangible, whether that's a piece of paper, a canvas, a recorded media electronically or on tape, that's an artistic creation that's under copyright. And the reason why it's so important is because as the artist, you want to make sure that, you know, someone doesn't take from what you've done and commercialize it without your permission. And copyright gives two big benefits. One, right away, as soon as it's done, as soon as it's fixed on that paper or recorded on the media, you have a common law copyright. And then, of course, you can seek registration to sort of buttress that. Going into trademark law is quite different. Trademarks, it's all about making sure that the consumer is clear about where this good or service came from, what's its source. And so you're thinking of brands and word marks and even colors and famous marks like McDonald's or Nike. Those are sort of great examples. You know, over time, they've become customers know as the products. You know, they see something, they see the swoosh or the golden arches, and they know what the product is and where it's going to come. With patent law, it is there's two types of patents. In the U.S. anyway, there's a design patent, which protects purely the way something looks. And so it's not as common, however, as the utility patent, which most people are thinking of with, you know, mechanical gears or with therapeutics or pharmaceutical electrical inventions and those sorts of things. And so there's three major requirements: is they need to be novel, needs to be first of its kind, non-obvious, above and beyond the prior art, and has to have utility and usefulness. So that's patent law in a nutshell. The fourth is trade secret law, I would say. Trade secrets are those things that companies, generally companies, it could be individuals, retain within their company that they could potentially seek patent protection for, but they've decided to try to keep them secret. And the reason being is they don't want to give it to the public at all. As part of patent law, I did mention this earlier, you know, you get a 20-year limited monopoly to use, make use, and prevent others from using it. With trade secrets, it could go on as long as it remains secret, so hundreds of years. I mean, think of the Coca-Cola recipe as a good example. They've had that for over 100 years and have enjoyed the value there. There are some other ancillary areas of IP, including privacy law, but I won't necessarily get into those. I mean, those are the main four.
Can I just go back to when you're talking about copyright and trademarking? I know you said with copyright, you get it automatically granted as soon as you create that piece of work. So mm-hmm. What's the difference? Obviously, I know in the UK we can't actually file for copyright, but I believe we can do it. People from the UK can still do it in the US. Is that correct?
Right. Yes, you can. So as an artist, I mean, anywhere in the world, if you want to seek protection for that work and be a documented author or if it's an artist or whatever it is you've created, you can seek registration at the Library of Congress. And you know, there's a few reasons for doing that. You know, by registering it, it becomes public record. And it documents the date and the author and what the work was. If ever you needed to bring an infringement suit, it's actually required if you're going to be suing in the U.S. court. If it was made, the registration has been made for over 5 years, it establishes what's called the prima facie evidence in court as being valid. So there's no objections or anyone basically infringing within the first 5 years. If it stands 5 years or longer, you've got the validity basis. And further, you know, it has the record that will be observed by any of the U.S. government agencies, including customs, potentially protect goods and any infringing copies coming in through the U.S. Customs and Border Protection.
And that's fairly cheap to do, isn't it? I don't mean, if I was to say apply for myself, it's relatively cheap to do that, isn't it?
Right, yes. I think it's around $50 to $100. I'd have to go look, depending on what it is you're trying to do. Of course, making sure that it's accurate is paramount. But yes, I mean, if people have done it successfully on their own. Others have decided to say, hey, look, you know, we want to make sure this is done right. And they've hired us to help them register it. But it is very straightforward and the fees are quite reasonable.
And trademarks, people also use them without being registered. So where would you stand if say, for example, I'd been using something I called a trademark. Look, there was no one else using it at the time. And I started trading under a name and just using, in the UK it's TM. Is it the same in the US if you're not actually registered?
Right. So if you just start selling goods, opening up shop, using a name, the common law rights that are given to that are the extent of the scope. So if you're only... If you say you've got a restaurant, you know, and you're serving folks just locally within your city, certainly only those within the state, that's going to be the range in which you have this common law protection, potentially, right? Assuming there's no other previously filed federal registration with that same mark. So the extent of your rights really covers only where your goods or services have been served. Many companies these days, especially in services, are going well beyond the borders of the cities and even states and now even the countries. And so it becomes even more important now to do a national search at a minimum to make sure that, one, you're not infringing on another's rights, or and two, you know, make sure you have a name that will be distinguishable between anyone else competing in the same industry, so that when you do all the hard work and your business succeeds, you won't be having a legal issue of having to maybe pay a royalty or have a perhaps even a trial if you've been infringing on someone else's mark.
So as creatives, is there anything we can do ourselves before we sort of came to someone like you to check that the thing we're trying to create or we're trying to trademark, copyright, patent, to make sure it doesn't already exist?
Yeah, I mean, at a very minimum, you've got to Google it. I mean, you know, and you've got to do your diligence there. I recommend doing that. Certainly before you pay the big bucks and have an attorney do that for you, you want to have done the work yourself first. And, you know, there's a really good government site. I mean, the USPTO.gov is great. They've really reformatted that and made it quite user-friendly. And there's good information, very good information, quite readily available. They've got good links. They even have some videos that are great to go over the basics for trademarks and for copyrights. And furthermore, they've got, for trademarks, they've got a very easily searchable database. It's the TESS, Trademark Electronic Search System, and it's right there within the USPTO.gov website, and you can go search terms. So if you've got a name of a business that you are intending on going into, you can definitely do that preliminary search there. Not for copyright. I mean, what's nice is that as long as it came from your own mind, it does not have to be unique. And so as an artist, it's not a requirement for your creative work to be unique as long as it came from your mind only. You didn't get it from someone else.
Wait, what do you mean by it doesn't have to be unique?
Well, I mean, in theory, someone could be painting the same painting or singing the same, you know, writing the same song at the same time, and both would get copyright protection over their works. Now, that's very rare, perhaps, but it could certainly happen if they could prove that they didn't derive their expression from each other. It's rather an interesting nuance of copyright law.
So what about things like inventor's notebooks? How useful are they sort of in a legal sort of way?
Well, I mean, much less so now. Since 2013, the American Invents Act has sort of gone away from what's called first to invent, which is the way we used to behave and function, to a first to file. And so while it's nice to have an inventor's notebook just to document your thoughts, really the impetus now is to make sure you file. And if you've got something that's potentially patentable, the incentives are to make sure you protect it. And the government is now awarding the merits to those that file first as opposed to those that try to prove inventorship. So in theory, if you have an invention, and you've got it in your head and think you could write it down with drawings and words, you should seek patent protection instead of trying to make it perfect. You can file a provisional patent application with fairly broad terms and covering lots of different alternative embodiments. And over the course of a year, you can really hone in on and finally then draft your claims after doing perhaps a little bit of testing and refining.
I'm always slightly confused on when you patent something, what's the actual bit that you patent? Because say I came up with an idea for a new toy. Would it be the mechanical thing in the toy that I could patent? How would it work?
Well, it's the claims. Claims. And it's, at least in the US, they don't put it right up front. They make you dig for it. But they're usually at the end of what's called the specification. And you'll see the words, you know, I claim or just claims, and they'll be numbered. That is what the patent owner has been awarded, been granted rights over. So it likely, very likely, is not the entire toy. It may not even be the mechanism. It might just be one part of the mechanism that the patent office said, yes, this function is what's novel. We have not seen this exact application of this function before. It's not obvious. It's a novel step above and beyond. That's what we're going to award the patent for. So great question. I mean, it's something that happens a lot is people think, you know, once they see patent number on a product, they think, oh my gosh, the whole thing has been patented. These guys are brilliant. Well, it could be. It's likely not the case. They probably just have a patent on a small aspect of it. And so that's something to really consider, especially if you're a competitor or in the industry. It's important to understand what exactly they have rights over, so you know what to avoid infringing, and so you know how to potentially exploit and incorporate what's not patented into your product or design.
So what's the difference between the provisional patent and the full patent when it's granted?
Well, it's an important distinction is there's no such thing as a provisional patent. There's a provisional patent application. So I always say that just to make sure inventors know that there's no rights given at the provisional stage and even at all during the application stage. What the provisional application does do, it allows you that early priority date. And so as soon as you have the enabled version of your invention to where you could explain it in words and drawings well enough such that someone like yourself could go build it from just the description alone, that's when you got to write it down and put it in and seek protection for it. The provisional application gives you that whole year, up to 1 year, to then file the non-provisional utility application that will make reference to the provisional. And so its major benefit is that time that you're the earlier time that you're getting it in.
So what happens if I filed or started filing the full patent and then I saw someone else had started producing pretty much the same thing that I was sort of claiming in my patent, which obviously hadn't been granted yet? What happens? Do I have any comeback at that point?
Well, you have the ability to write them a nasty letter about your prospective rights. But no, you don't have any actual vested rights yet. But by putting them on notice, you're doing a big thing that they're taking a risk. Once they've been put on notice that if your rights do grant, they've now become willfully infringing of your patent. So there are ways to seek retroactive damages back to the date of notification. Even while those rights were still pending, their decision to continue to infringe prospective rights could be awarded to the rights holder.
So I guess it depends what sort of longevity you think the product's got, does it?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it turns into a lot of times, in that scenario, you sort of become a one of these patent trolls, a little mini patent troll, because once this company has said they've been in business now for a year, it takes a while to get through the patent system. They're likely not going to want to just shut down their whole system. They're probably going to be willing to negotiate a license agreement with you as the rights holder to continue manufacturing. Of course, depends case by case, but that'd be a good equitable solution. And we've seen it before.
So what is licensing?
Well, it's really, once you have a right, once you have a copyright, a trademark, patent, you can decide to say, okay, well, I would like to monetize this outside of myself or my own company. And I'd like to, in some way, allow a third party rights to use the intellectual property, make it, use it, sell it, offer it for sale. You can give just a little piece. I mean, for example, you can allow one company to manufacture only your patented product, or just the ability to sell it for you on your behalf, right? Or you can license the whole thing and allow very few restrictions. You can restrict and be very specific about what geography. You could be, if you've got worldwide protection, say in 5 different countries, you could say, well, look, company, I'm going to allow you to make, use, and sell this in Australia only. So it's really neat. I mean, it's contracts law at its core, but what's fun is that you've got IP is what's being transacted. So there's lots of different ways to slice it and make very unique custom transactions.
Do you know what sort of percentages people usually get from licensing?
Oh, it's all over. You know, ballpark, you know, royalty rate on a non-exclusive, you know, those are where you're allowing at least, you know, two or more companies to use it. You can expect between 2 and 5% royalty on sale, you know, gross sale. On exclusives, I suppose you could get closer to 10% on royalties. Those are just, I mean, it depends. I mean, I know pharmaceuticals they can go higher. Consumer products tend to be lower. So generally, the more complex the invention, the higher the royalty rate. But those are kind of the ballpark figures.
Okay. Once you've got your IP, if someone infringes, we haven't got loads of money, which is usually the case in the case of creators. Is there anything we can do?
Yes. I mean, you've got to do, you know, some diligence. It can be a kind of an emotional thing when you believe you've found an infringer. You've got to make sure that they are indeed infringing. And work with your attorney, if you've got one, to look at your claims. Look at exactly how your alleged infringer is using the product to confirm that they are indeed, you know, reading on the claims, and that, you know, before you bring suit or even before you write a cease and desist letter, that you've got an opinion of infringement by an attorney. You know, it takes it way past the, oh my gosh, you're stealing my idea. You know, so you really are selling a product that we have granted patent claims for, and having that validated is important first step. As I said, usually a letter writing camp, you know, is sort of the next step once you confirm infringement. Individual or business gets a letter from an attorney, they're likely going to take it very seriously. Most of these cases will settle, especially if there's a strong case for infringement.
I guess, is it quite difficult to sort of enforce in other countries?
Yes, and I must say I don't have really any experience with patent pre-litigation or litigation in foreign countries.
Okay.
But it gets extremely difficult, you know, trying to manage that. But it comes down to just making sure you have co-counsel barred and registered in those other foreign entities or countries, rather than trusting them to take care of your clients there.
Nowadays, everybody puts everything online. So, you know, if I create a bit of art, for example, it goes online. People put their, you know, their writing, everything. Are there any implications to us doing that?
Well, you know, I think it depends on what it is. If, you know, if it's the blog writing is very popular, but it's a good example. And if it's on your website, and you know it was something you created personally or someone on your team, and so you know it's your company's IP, you know it is important to understand where it's being distributed to, and to at least, you know, do the minimum where you identify, you know, the author in the article and put, you know, copyright your company and then the year of creation. It adds merit to it, and it puts it right there with the document. So you've got the author, you've got the company, the year of authorship. You're basically creating a little mini registration by publishing it in that way. But I think maybe where you were going is how to tell if someone is stealing it or maybe monitoring it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, you can go crazy. I mean, trying to figure it out. You know, whether it's worth it to do it. So it depends on what the piece is, right? If you spend months and months writing, you know, a book or writing a really, really well-done article, white paper, it's called, you know, then maybe it is worth maybe doing periodic quarterly or even monthly checks, queries on Google to see if anyone has perhaps picked it up. And but it sort of is all kind of based on what value it is to you and your company, and whether it's worth your time to do it yourself or hire an expert to do the monitoring for you.
I asked on Facebook if anybody got any questions for you, and I think we've covered one. But someone asked, what do creators always forget to think about? Is it protecting their creations worrying about infringing others, so make sure we don't infringe others, or rights, or both?
Well, one of the most difficult parts of copyright law, and I will say I'm not an expert in this. I do some opinions on it. Many artists get tripped up in when is a work a derivative work, or when is a work different enough from prior works to be its own creation? And it's very difficult, especially in music, for example. I mean, there's so much music that has already been written, performed to date, and it's really perhaps impossible to come up with something truly unique and brand new. I mean, maybe that covers all different art genres, but and so it is important to, once you have a track, you know, an album, maybe even an album put together, and you put a lot of effort into it, to have it reviewed for potential infringement. It's, you know, especially if it's something that, you know, this is what a record label would do already, but if you were going to be independent and do your diligence, you'd want to have a third party listen to it. You know, as the artist, you're probably a bit biased. just listen to, hey, does this sound at all like anyone else? Is any riffs here or any rhythms, you know, right away jump out as, you know, someone else's music? Similar types of inquiries for other artwork. Those are kind of the tougher questions, and where a lot of, you know, litigation happens down the road.
Yeah, it's so hard because things go in your subconscious and you don't even know they've gone in.
Totally. Yeah, it's a very hard thing. And like I said, I don't do a lot of it. There are others that specify just on music law.
Yeah.
You know, there are music, even entertainment law specialists. Well, our firm generally focuses on the patents and trademark.
So can you talk a little bit about what your firm does?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we've tried to take special care to be open and available to inventors of all walks, really, garage inventors and Fortune 500 companies, and work very carefully and via a boutique. What's unique about our firm is that we do offer that boutique specialized, you know, one-on-one patent attorney to client relationship from a virtual point of view. So we've gone away from the brick and mortar, marble floors, and the, you know, the front desk and the physical spaces to meeting our clients where they are, and being agile, and being able to do a video consult, a phone call, more readily available, and not have to have them drive downtown and park and that sort of thing. So we have it's a virtual firm. We have patent attorneys that are all over the country that have backgrounds, technology backgrounds, and industry, you know, on the job training in many fields, and so I've been fortunate enough to meet and be partnered with these patent attorneys in lots of disciplines that I am not familiar with. I mean, electrical engineering, computer science, pharmaceutical, you name it. We've got at least one person in that field.
So your specialism is mainly on the patent side.
It is. We enjoy it, and so a lot of our clients will begin that process. And what's fun is that I try to encourage them to think about the business side of what they're doing, and try to think about the end game with, you know, protecting a technology. Oftentimes, inventors will come in and think, "Oh, I just can't wait till I get that patent. Then the money will start flowing in." And I've got to break it to them that, you know, I'm sorry, no, you've got to put a plan together, either a business plan to grow a business yourself, or perhaps put a plan together to license or sell the IP asset. Both of those still take work and need to be considered when you, even while you're acquiring the asset, to make sure that you're doing the right amount of testing and networking to make sure that comes to fruition and it doesn't end up being a piece of paper in the end.
Sure.
So yeah, we offer a full service business planning that comes with the technology protection. So I've got three business consultants now on my team. And it's my, like I said, my background, I went to business school, and so I've got a passion for this. So as it happens, a lot of the technology that we help protect, it turns into a product, and they need help protecting their business name. And so we end up helping them with their trademark. So this is how it's sort of gone. It's been about the invention and the technology first, and it sort of goes on beyond that, helping them with protecting their mark and moving their business forward.
So where can people find out more about you?
Well, I've got a website, boldip.com. That's B as in boy, O-L, D as in dog, I-P as in Paul.com. There's tons of info there. You can read about me under the Bold team. I'm the owner, founding patent attorney. And we got lots of unique, colorful, very inspiring patent attorneys and other attorneys here on our site as well. You can read about them and their backgrounds too.
Do you do the social media thing or not?
Oh my gosh, yes, we love it. I mean, we're where we can be. It's impossible to be everywhere. We've got a Facebook page as well. We've got our LinkedIn page is not quite as active, but we're definitely on Twitter, sharing our blog articles that come out at least once every week. And, I mean, my attorneys can write. There are some really fun articles here. We just did one about solar cells, thermal photovoltaic cell as being the next solar field panel. There's also one we did, a decision that just came down about trademarks. In the U.S., it's a big decision that came down where offensive trademarks are now registrable. So, one of the big ones was the Redskins football team. There was a band called the Slants, sort of maybe a racially empowered or statement. Anyway, so we've written about lots of different subjects in there. People are commenting on the social media.
Oh, great. Okay, well, thank you ever so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tara. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. If you want to keep up to date with the new podcasts and articles, sign up for my newsletter at ideamedic.com.